Today we're speaking to Arthur Manuel, a member of the Nisqually Indian Band of the Shwepam Nation, British Columbia, and he's the spokesperson for the Indigenous Network on Economies and Trade, a network of Indigenous organizations fighting for recognition of Aboriginal and treaty rights at the international level. He's also the spokesperson for the upcoming Grassroots People's Coalition meeting on November 24th and 25th in Kelowna, BC, which will parallel and oppose the Liberal government's First Minister's meeting, which the mainstream media have been proclaiming as a historic meeting to close the gap on quality of life issues for First Nations people. These meetings will be the focus of today's show. Welcome, Arthur, to the program.
Thank you.
So, Arthur, I thought that we could start out, for those who don't know, maybe you could explain from the perspective of people engaged in this First Minister's meeting what the goal or agenda of the meeting is.
Well, I think probably the goal is to try and reduce and eliminate the poverty of Indigenous people through a 10-year program. And Joel Fontaine and the Canadian government have identified the lack of good health programs, the housing backlog, and inadequate education, and the lack of economic capital investment in areas of economic development as the area to focus on for the next 10 years, and they're sort of trying to call on the premiers to join in this strategy. So that's what their goal is.
Okay, and so you have been involved in organizing a parallel meeting to this process, and also will be having a demonstration outside of the First Minister's meeting. So I'm sure, especially following all the news reportage about the Cashechuan so-called crisis and all that kind of stuff, a lot of people out there were probably wondering or find it hard to understand why people would protest a meeting where it said that a commitment of between $4 to $5 billion over the next 10 years will be authorized basically to eradicate Indigenous poverty. So how would you explain to people the problem with the First Minister's process and what your idea of a real solution would be?
Well, I think the real problem is that the Canada is trying to treat the symptoms and not the cause, because what's not going to be talked about at the First Minister's conference is Aboriginal and treaty rights. And, you know, the real problem with the poverty in Indigenous peoples is that the economic system in this country is wrong, because it's based upon basically stealing or having Indigenous people subsidize the Canadian economy, because it's our land and resources that are being used to develop wealth in this country. And the thing is that the government in the process they're presently engaged in have sidelined the discussion of Aboriginal treaty rights. And it's the recognition that, you know, the Canadian government and the provincial governments recognized Aboriginal and treaty rights, poverty amongst Indigenous people would instantly be removed. Right now, what really needs to be fixed is the Canadian economy, but the Canadian strategy in Kelowna is to try and have Indigenous people assume the blame for our impoverishment by saying to us that they're going to give us $5 billion so we can fix ourselves, because we have a housing backlog of about 80,000 homes. That we have poor health because of the living conditions that we are forced to live in, because, you know, that whole Indian reserve system, even up in the north there, those people used to live out on the land, you know, distributed in over the territory, and that kind of problem wouldn't exist. But it's the Department of Indian Affairs Indian Reserve policy that forces us to live on these Indian reserves, you know. actually a genocide when they move people off of their land for the purposes of destroying their culture.
Following up on that idea of, there's a whole bunch of media backlash, I guess, regarding the so-called crisis in Keshechuan, where tons of people, especially from Canadian Taxpayers Federation and stuff like that, started writing that it's time to abolish the reserves, and several people are also calling for that to be part of the agenda of the First Minister's meeting.
I think the thing is that, you know, the reserve system as a community base for Indian people is necessary in some parts of the country, but mm-hmm. definitely in Treaty 9, I think Ontario and the Taxpayers Federation should move totally right out of there. The people from the Anishinaabe Nation should rule that territory with exclusive jurisdiction with regard to land and regard to the sovereignty in which they have had recognized by, you know, the government through signing those treaties.
What I've read about this First Minister's Conference is that a lot of opposition is coming up around basically the federal government trying to shift its or get rid of its fiduciary responsibility to First Nations people and put it onto the provinces. And this morning I read an article, or it was a news brief, I guess, sent by Andy Scott, talking about the Mackenzie Valley pipeline. And basically, the people working on that pipeline were worried that they'd have to pay taxes to the First Nations people living in that area. But Andy Scott said, oh, don't worry about it. The Fiscal and Statistical Management Act only applies to First Nations governments who have signed a self-government agreement. So I was wondering if you could explain a bit why some First Nations are basically opposed to signing these self-governance agreements.
Well, I think one of the things is that, you know, every time Indian people come up with a terminology like self-government or talking about, indigenous sovereignty, the government always gets their weasel worders together and they always design policies, programs, and legislation in order to try and usurp those more genuine initiatives by indigenous people. So when we talk about self-government agreements, you need to put into context that they're really not necessarily self-government agreements. You know, they're actually, if Canada would apply the intelligence of the Canadian people to try and figure out how to reconcile our differences instead of trying to deviate and to circumvent, to undermine and destroy and extinguish rights, you know, we would move a lot further ahead. So the thing is that these people aren't necessarily against self-government. What they're really against is the kind of self-government that the government is trying to force down our throats, you know. There's no question, according to Aboriginal and treaty rights in this country, that Indigenous people are entitled to tax monies that are raised as a consequence of employment and economic opportunities that are generated from their natural wealth and resources, you know. You know, and one thing that's very clear at the international level is that the United Nations Human Rights Committee, in relationship to the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, asked Canada what it was doing in relationship to Article 1 with respect to self-determination for Aboriginal peoples in Canada. And Canada has basically failed answering that question because they don't really do anything. But basically what the Article 1 in this covenant says that Canada agrees to and has signed on to says that all peoples, with an S, peoples, nations, are entitled to freely choose their own political system and freely dispose of their natural wealth and resources, and that governments can't intervene in that. And so that's like a fiduciary responsibility there for Canada. And in the Canadian Constitution, it's clear that under Section 35(1) that the Canadian government refers to Indigenous people or Aboriginal peoples with an S. So they recognize us as a nation, you know, and they break the law when they don't allow us to freely choose our own political system. They fail when they don't allow us to freely dispose of our natural wealth and resources. And that all goes back to what the pipeline issue is up there, you know, and taxation rights. they basically are trying to circumvent that by getting Indian people, and they use their money, they use our poverty as a weapon against us, because they use their money to basically set the direction, the political direction for Indian organizations. And they get them to sign a lot of lousy deals, you know, like the Nishka deal is a terrible, terrible deal, you know. And the Yukon deal is a terrible deal, too, you know. And they basically are trying to steamroll Indian people into signing terrible deals like that here in British Columbia. So, and we stand up against that because it's morally bankrupt what Canada's doing. There's no question about it, you know. And they... Human Rights Committee in Geneva, after we made our presentation, they're saying some of the things that I'm just saying here, actually basically condemned Canada for its continuation of extinguishment policy, but under the basis of modified rights and non-asserted rights, the new weasel words that they use for extinguishment in this country. And, Canada, you know, the Canadian people have to hold their government accountable. That's what I feel.
It seems a really, really, really coercive method of trying to get people to sign deals by saying, you know, you won't be able to be engaged in any of the economic development or receive any of the benefits of the theft of your land and resources unless you sign on to these agreements. I was wondering, with the First Minister's meeting and all this promised provincial money and the whole devolution process, is there going to be the same kind of requirements made of different nations or bands to sign on to things in order to receive these monies? Is there some kind of body that they have to have in order to receive them?
Oh, yeah. Every one of the agreements that I've seen lately from the province of British Columbia, or even from the Canadian government, there's clauses in which prohibit Indigenous organizations from engaging and demonstrating and taking political action other than following the agreement, or the agreement would be terminated. You know, there's a lot of the agreements have that, you know. It's more of an exception than the rule if they don't have it. You know, if there's one or two out there that somebody can come back and say, oh, Art Manuel's full of, beans, because there are some that say that doesn't have that. But the majority of them that I've seen have them in them, you know, like the Range Forest agreements here in British Columbia. I know the BC Treaty agreements where they borrow money to negotiate have those kinds of things. And so that's what they sort of use as ability to control. So, you know, that's where they use poverty, our own poverty, as a weapon, mm-hmm. a real, real weapon against us. And Canadians should be totally ashamed of that kind of activity. You know, Canada objects to international pressure like that, but yet they'll use that same kind of pressure on Indigenous people domestically. You know, I think that's total hypocrisy on the part of the Canadian government. And they'll use that in court against us, because I know in Squawkwaqwalt, when we're fighting against the expansion of Sun Peaks, the Canadian government and the provincial government in that case used whatever deals they made with Indians mm-hmm. as a basis of trying to tell the judge, these are radical, they're dissident, or, you know, they're anarchists, they don't represent their people, you know, because here we got all these sweetheart deals, you know, and they'll start listing out all the sweetheart deals they got, you know.
Hey!
gets his 10-year sweetheart deal, they're going to use that against every Indian activist that wants to protect the ecological biodiversity of his territory, whether it be in northern Ontario or the people at Barrier Lake up in north of Montreal there, you know, that are working on that trilateral agreement out there. You know, those people will be punished because of those kinds of 10-year deals. You know, they'll say, well, we're not going to be talking about the land rights. The, you know, your national chief has agreed we're going to talk about trying to fix you Indians up because you got the housing backlog, because you have inadequate education, because you have poor health, and you have no economic... You guys are the problem. You know, that's what they'll be saying in court, you know?
There was an article in the Globe and Mail yesterday just talking about this conference, and the way that they said it, they said that they're at the conference, they're trying not to get bogged down in the esoteric debate that doomed previous attempts at major government action on Native issues. So it's like, once again, it's the fault of Indigenous people that you have these lofty ideals that are radical and way out there and not at all achievable, even though they're based in international law as well as Canadian law. It seems that they've had lots of conferences and roundtables and studies and spent millions of dollars trying to figure out how to move forward. But then when the results come in, they're gathering dust policies. They just sit on the shelf and, like, they totally ignore what's coming of that. So do you see any hope in this announcement that they will be gathering in the spring of 2006 to discuss this issue?
Well, one of the things that's very clear is that, you know, Aboriginal rights and treaty rights have to be the priority. You know, the stuff that they're talking about here in terms of priorities, you know, you should, you know, there are problems at the community level with respect to education, health, and housing, you know. Yeah. But if you're going to develop long-term, if you're going to put the rest of poverty existing that causes those problems, you need to talk about recognition of Aboriginal treaty rights. And I think that agenda has to be number one and not number two, the way they're sort of putting it here. And I'd have to see the agenda, because basically the Canadian government has been using a lot of word twisting. And the other thing is that they stand that way when it comes to judicial matters, because even in every court case you're in, Canada stands up against you. So if you want to find out who your friends or enemies are, you go to the courthouse, and if they're standing up on the other side against you, then you know they don't have any recognition of your Aboriginal treaty rights. And that's where Canada always stands. So the thing is that when you look at those kind of debates that Canada is saying they're trying to involve, It won't work unless Canada changes its fundamental position on recognition of Aboriginal treaty rights. To sit down and talk to them before they recognize that you have your Aboriginal treaty rights is going to lead to failure, because they're going to constantly use that process as a basis to try and either put a political spin, try to extinguish your title through some form of rewording of the document. Mm-hmm. You know, the record is our evidence in this respect. So the thing is that those kind of meetings like that, you know, they can spout off about, but until Canada itself changes its policy, that kind of discussion is pretty moot in many respects, I would think, you know.
I just was wondering if you don't mind talking a little bit about the mobilization that you're preparing for the 24th and 25th for this meeting, and who is involved in it, and basically talk as much as you can about what it is and what you hope you will achieve.
Well, one of the things that we want to achieve is to put rights back on the table, to make sure that Phil and the Canadian government don't get away with making this a big money deal, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, first of all, I really get embarrassed when we're standing up, you know, that money, whatever money we do get from the government, you know, Indian people are owed nevertheless, you know, simply because they're... Every Canadian is earning money on Indian land, let's put it that way, and they owe Indian people money for using that land. So the so we're entitled to that. But I really get annoyed when the media and other people sort of make us look like a bunch of bums, you know?
Yeah, totally.
And you know, that disturbs me. You know, I never asked Phil to go bum any money for me for these things, you know? And so he's out there doing that, and that kind of embarrasses me quite a bit.
Yeah.
But anyways, he's making a big public spectacle of that. And so we're addressing that. We don't really believe in this, Phil. We don't really believe in the Canadian agenda in this regard, you know. And so we want to put rights forward, like I said before. Okay, so there's some people that we've been talking to. Like we deal basically with grassroots movements and some organizations across Canada. Then we also got the Indian Friendship Center of Kelowna involved. You know, they're going to be making their kitchens available. And I don't know, we're planning for about around 400 to 500 people to show up. And I've been talking to some people who, right clean across the country, that have been phoning, giving their support, and saying that, you know, it's about time somebody stood up for the rights and pushed that agenda, you know. Everybody suffers in terms of education, housing, you know, all these things. My own family, my own children, my own cousins and own relatives do, but they realize that rights is really important, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, biting the bullet on some of these other issues, they know is necessary if we want to get through to the government, that we need to get to the real issue, which is land rights, you know. Because there's no use. My dad, George Manuel, who used to be the president of the National Indian Brotherhood and started up the World Council of Indigenous People and used to be the president of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, he used to tell me when I was just a little kid, he said, you don't talk about self-government first. He says, you talk about Indian land rights. And he'd say, you need to do that because what are you going to govern if you don't know anything about your land rights first? You know? And so he used to be pretty clear about that. And so that's the old-time wisdom that a lot of the older people, grassroots people, really feel we need to deal with first, because they're the ones that are impacted directly by the expansion of Sun Peaks. They're the ones directly impacted when Shell Oil moves into their area up in the Tahltan Nation, you know what I mean? And so they know it's land rights first, because it's Shell Oil that takes the food out of their mouth. You know, it's Sun Peaks that takes the food out of my people's mouth, you know?
Yeah.
And nothing is, no compensation, no discussion. All Gordon Campbell will say is, we got a new relationship. I'm putting $100 million on the table. Mm-hmm. You know, anybody that's been in business, and I'm also an entrepreneur, too. I'm not just totally anti-business and this kind of stuff. I know $100 million is chicken feed, you know?
Yeah.
And then the feds are talking $4 billion, you know? You know, Air Canada can go into a $4 billion deficit. You know, this kind of stuff. And they're talking about Indians getting this kind of stuff all across the country, you know? And I don't believe. Distributed, you know, the only people that are going to get that $4 billion, I can tell you right now, is going to be the people at the Band Administration Office. And that's Phil's support. Phil Fontaine used to work for Indian Affairs. I think he was a regional director general at one time, you know? And he did, when he was in Manitoba, have the strategy of taking over Indian Affairs, you know. This is just a more grandiose effort to try and do that at the national level, this 10-year program he's talking about. But it isn't going to help one Indian in the next 10 years, and the government will be off the hook on Indian rights for 10 years, you know, because they're going to put rights secondary, and they'll say they're off the hook because they've put $404 billion on the table already, you know?
Meanwhile, officially they say they're going to throw all this money into those problems, which usually undermines whatever solutions communities might be working on and have in place to deal with their own issues.
Well, one of the things is the housing. You know, on my reserve, one of the young men built a straw bale house, you know?
Yeah.
And he had a hell of a time to get the grant from the Department of Indian Affairs for that, because I don't know, people don't understand this along across Canada, but Indian people do pay for the houses on their reserves. I know a lot of those redneck taxpayer groups say that Indian people get free housing. No, we wind up mortgaging with the Royal Bank of Canada, the Imperial Bank of Commerce, all this kind of stuff. And I know that because I was a chief for 8 years, you know, and I was a tribal chairman for 6 years, so I know that. I ran these programs, eh? But I know that people mortgage these houses. Like in our reserve, the average house is about $100,000, eh?
Yeah.
And young people, because of the unemployment level, can't afford it, so they're forced to live on welfare to pay for the house, because it's a social assistance program that pays for the mortgage if they're on social assistance, you know. But so young people are saying, I don't want to go into a $100,000 mortgage house. I just don't want it. Because the department will grant about around $23,000 grant for each one of those $100,000 houses. They say, we want to build one for under $23,000. We can build a cob house, you know. Yeah. We can build a straw bale house for under that. And then I'm not going to be in debt, and I'm not going to get stuck on welfare, you know, trying to pay for these houses, you know. But the government isn't going for that, you know. They're not setting up programs for alternative forms of housing so our young people can build homes. You know, you can build a good straw bale house, you know, for fairly cheap, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's what that kind of program that the Prime Minister is talking about will totally undermine that. What they want to do is get us locked into a standard kind of housing project that non-Indian people are involved in off-reserve, but the economy and the reserve just can't deal with it. So, you know, we need to talk about it that way. I think in terms of education, where they're talking about getting the provinces involved in order to try and beef up funding for therapists and special needs teachers and stuff like that, I think it's totally wrong. I think the feds are legally obliged to cover that kind of funding for schooling on Indian reserves, and they did at one point in time say they were committed to Indian control of Indian education. They have to live up to those things. They don't need to involve the province. By involving the province, all they're going to do is add another level of bureaucrats. You know, so you're going to have federal bureaucrats, provincial bureaucrats, and Indian bureaucrats. And that ain't going to help Indian education one bit, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So I totally disagree with that strategy, you know. So in terms of Indian health care, I think there's a lot of work that traditional Indian healers, especially from the grassroots movement, need to be respected for, especially in terms of, like, in Sun Peaks. There's a lot of Indian medicine up there. You know, one time just before a meeting was happening, old Sarah Denault was picking Indian medicine about around 100 feet from where the meeting was being held at Sun Peaks, you know. And Sun Peaks is destroying those Indian medicine barrier areas, you know. Those are things that, you know, that health program doesn't address. You know, it's just talking about how do you beef up problems after people get into serious health problems. It doesn't talk about how do you build up the health system of indigenous people. There's a lot of problems there. So I think the thing is that I don't agree with that for other reasons, but, you know, primarily I don't agree for their rights. But if you take a look at what they're doing, there's a lot of wrong things they're doing.
It seems like there's this whole industry of people that are getting money, like the money's, if say there's this $4 to $5 billion being promised, well, how much will actually go to the people in the communities and how much will go to these industries, maybe like, you know, Canadian Mortgage and Housing Association or whatever it's called, instead of to the actual people who could build the houses on their own. You know, that seems to me part of the problem too, is that there's this whole industry involved that doesn't want to give up their stake in the monies.
Yeah, I sort of believe in that. You know, I sort of believe what you're saying, that there's an industry around the poverty of my people, you know, and I don't like it, you know. You know, I think that, you know, when you talk about sort of political pimps or poverty pimps that are out there dealing with this issue, I think, you know, we need to get them out of the picture, you know, because a lot of that stuff that I see coming down the pipe, I know my grandchildren aren't going to see one penny of that $4 billion, you know, not one penny, you know. In that sense, maybe we sort of agree that with the other side that those things shouldn't be funded that way, because the people at the community level, you know, the solutions have to come from the community and go up instead of coming from Ottawa coming down. And this one is from a top-down solution, you know, and it just ain't going to work, you know. I think they need to have the bottom-up solution, and that's where money and resources have to be allocated from the bottom up, because I know we could get rid of the housing problem in British Columbia if Indian people were allowed to access trees to bring onto the reserve and build homes, you know, and the young people would learn to trade in building, you know. I know we would be able to do that in terms of straw bale, cob house, all these different things, would put them all together, and the communities and it'll get the young people active. Instead of getting involved in taking crystal meth and this kind of stuff, they would be involved in actually doing something very positive, you know. The way it is right now, you wait for a grant from CMHC to come from Ottawa. The only thing you can pick in your house is the color of the wall and, you know, that kind of stuff. That doesn't work, you know, and it just leads for more idolism. And so I think, there's people that can live off of that, but I really resent that. You know, I think that kind of stuff has to go.
I was wondering, because you mentioned earlier that, you know, Canadians have to be responsible for telling their government or, like, trying to stop their government to keep on with this colonial agenda. And in terms of strategy, I was wondering two things. First, how do you think Canadians who are outraged about this all can plug in to the resistance movement, or, like, which government bodies, I guess, are the most important to address? And then second, for people who've heard this interview today and want to be part of the protest and meeting in Kelowna, how can they get involved in that?
Well, I think people have to realize that, you know, the government, like I said before, has failed. You know, your constitution calls for protection and recognition of Aboriginal tree rights, you know, and your Supreme Court has said that in Delgamuukw and other legal cases with regard to Aboriginal and treaty rights, you know. And when your government fails to live up to what the Constitution and the court says, then it falls on the shoulder of the ordinary Canadian to tell its government to fall in line with what your courts and what your Constitution says, you know. So there is a real direct obligation. That's what, if people talk about democracy, that's what democracy really is all about. It isn't necessarily about responsible governments. It's about Canadians, you know, ordinary, everyday Canadians taking responsibility. So they have to organize to get, you know best as Canadians how to influence your member of parliament. You know, you guys are the ones that elect or don't elect members of parliament, and people have to say to the parliamentarian, you know, get with it. You know, it's going to hurt. It's going to be painful. Change always is, but we're sick and tired of Indian people being impoverished the way they have been. Let's sort that out by recognizing their rights, and you need to get that message across, you know, whether you need to rally and picket in front of a member of parliament's office, you know, to get that message across. You know, you need to get thousands of people out there demonstrating in front of their offices to get the message out. You know, mobilization, I think, is probably the best way of communicating, you know, to the Canadian parliamentarians and the Canadian public to generate the interest, generate the discussion. I think that's the direction.
So a big decolonization movement.
Right.
I think that would be a wonderful thing to see in Canada.
I think so. The Australians did it. They weren't very successful at the end of that thing, but they did get millions of people out, and I think we need to get millions of Canadians out. And I think it would be a real reassertion of Canadian democracy. It would be a real reassertion of protecting the ecological biodiversity. It would also be a real serious movement to set a new standard for the treatment of Indigenous people, to have Indigenous people and settlers sort of learn to live together fairly and justly.
For people who want to get involved in the demo, is there a way?
I think there's some
meeting?
People organizing some support demos. You have to check the internet. Sure, I got my cell number on there. It's 250-319-0688.
Okay, if they want to hop on the bus and get going.
Hop on the bus, they can phone me and they can figure out how they can do that wherever they are.